'Tis the season to shine with H&M. Discover the holiday collection and find fashionable pieces for your wardrobe or for under the tree. Get inspired and dazzle with this year's glam. From tuxedo styles, bow detailed pieces, impressive prints, and more. From unforgettable looks to unforgettable gifts. With fashion finds to home decor, find it all at H&M. Treat your loved ones and yourself this season. Shop in-store or at hm.com.
Hey guys, do me a favor, if you haven't already, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Then go to BurtBurtBurt.com and subscribe to all my social media outlets or whatever. I don't know if subscribe is the right word, but you know what I mean. I'm really thinking about my YouTube page. That's what I want you to subscribe to because I've been posting my daily vlog. Not daily, it's like bi-weekly. I think more comics should do it. And I think that in 5 years from now, when every comic's got a vlog, you're going to be like, wow, I followed Burt at the ground floor. He was doing a vlog back when they were really pretty shitty. These aren't shitty. I'm learning about editing. I'm learning about shooting. And if you follow my vlog, you will learn about my weight loss, December weight loss challenge, which I'm down 20 pounds, not to be a spoiler alert. You will see me podcast with my friends. You will see me go to people's podcasts. You will hear clips from those podcasts. You will hear off-air stuff from those podcasts. And I take them to live shows that I do. I did the goddamn comedy jam. Sarah Silverman was there. Louis C.K. was there, although Louis is not in the vlog because I didn't want to deal with the hassle. And you see me in assless chaps. You then also will learn about the battles I'm having with my neighbor's car and the stuff that I'm secretly putting on their car, like pinstripes. And, oh, the one I'm releasing today is pretty fucking good. Me and my daughters go in and put a pretty aggressive sticker on the back of their window. And they got us back last night. And I'm putting all this on my vlog. So check out my vlog. Today's guest is an honor to have on the podcast. I got a text from Barry Katz, legendary manager Barry Katz, asking if I was interested in having a conversation with him, and I was like, get the fuck out. Yes, sir, please. He was on the 60 Minutes 2 in the Andy Rooney seat. He was a correspondent for 60 Minutes 2. He's been on every late-night talk show there is, including my favorite one that ever existed, Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. He's had HBO specials. He's been in movies. He's done more one-man shows than you can ever throw a stick at. He is a Boston comedy legend, and he's doing a show at the Wilbur Theater this New Year's Eve. If you want tickets, go to thewilbur.com. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Jimmy Tingle.
This is Wilbur Cast.
Hold them. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a nice space, Bert.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's fantastic. Let me rephrase that. I make it sound, I'm like brushing it off, but the truth is,
yeah,
it screwed us because now we don't want to leave the house, but we've outgrown the house.
Yeah.
Like the family has. The girls are, here we go, I run video. I was literally, as I'm setting this up, I was like, how different is something like this? Like, when was your first trip to LA? Was it to do Carson?
It wasn't my first trip, but.
When was your first trip?
My first trip was actually to do Star Search.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What year is that?
That was like 83, 84.
What was
around there?
I hate to do an interview and then say like I'm so fascinated that you've been doing stand up since like what? 80,
the 80s.
82?
Yeah. 80.
80?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm,
are we on?
Yeah,
are
yeah,
we
yeah, we're rolling. Yeah. Cool. And all as I was setting this up, I thought the change you've seen in entertainment and in comedy and in every aspect of this business, mm-hmm. from starting in the clubs to Dane Cook doing social media to mm-hmm. podcasting has got to be like, I felt silly putting a camera in here, and I was like, cool man. But I was like, one time you flew out to LA to do Carson, like that.
Yeah,
that's such a. I mean, that's so out of any experience I could ever have, I feel like.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you. Yeah, when I first started, 1980, we started in Boston, and there wasn't really, there was a scene there, but there wasn't an industry scene. So it was just people doing what they, wanted to do. It was like the big challenge was getting on and doing 5 minutes and doing well, and then doing 20 minutes and then getting paid gigs. As all these, I was fortunate that I kind of caught the wave early on
yeah.
in the early 80s, where there was an expansion of the clubs. People were... you know, clubs were opening around the country. If you could get, you know, 20, 30 minutes, an hour together, you could headline around the country. And so that was, but everything was just, you know, it was the old fashioned, you know, three newspapers in the town or one newspaper per town.
Three channels on TV.
I mean, Carson was the only show in town, actually.
Really?
Pretty much. I mean, Johnny Carson was, I mean, for comics, that was like the gold standard at the time, you know. And Star Search was on, you know, Star Search was on in the early 80s. That was another vehicle for people to get on, do 2 minutes to the country.
Do you remember what jokes you did?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I can still do them, man. Because, you know, I did a one-man show a few years ago. And
you've done a number of one-man shows, right?
And I reenacted the Star Search bit. And Steve Allen came to the show. And he goes, listen, man, don't throw that material out. That's good material. He goes, you can use it. And I'm thinking.
You can repurpose it now.
Oh, yeah.
People these days will.
Oh, yeah. I just did a. I occasionally speak in different places for recovery issues, you know.
Yeah.
So I was playing. I was speaking at a prison in Massachusetts, the Billerica House of Correction, and I'm doing Q&A with the inmates, you know, and one guy goes, who are you on Star Search? Where were you on Star Search? Who are you on with? I said, I was on with Evan Davis, and I think it was like 83, 84, maybe 85, and I go, I'll reenact it for you. Nice to be here, everybody. Ed McMahon says, our next challenger tonight is a comedian from Boston, Massachusetts. He admires Rodney Dangerfield and Richard Pryor. He sees himself in 5 years just writing, performing, and working. Let's put him to work right now. Please welcome Jimmy Tingle. Hey, everybody. Nice to be here tonight. I drove out here from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm driving cross-country. I broke a few rules driving. Next thing you know, the police pull us over. What's the story, pal? Why'd you run that red light? I didn't see you, officer. What are you, a wise guy? You got a license? Well, of course I have a license. I show him the license. He looks at the license, looks at me. He looks at the license, looks at me. This doesn't look like you. Well, let me see that. You're right. It's not me. You got the wrong guy. Oh, man. I've been trying to get in shape, folks. My friend said, you want to get in shape? Just lift weights, man. Lift weights. I'm saying, lift weights? What for? Those things are heavy. People tell me to jog. Get out there and jog, man. Jog, jog, jog. If you can jog 1 mile, you could jog the Boston Marathon. Calm down. I can't drive 26 miles without pulling over to hit a men's room. People say, try the health food. You are what you eat. Really? I don't feel like a large Italian with everything on it. Health food? I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust the store. As soon as you walk in, a man with the physique of this wire comes up to me to tell me that the vegetables look healthy. Yeah, the vegetables look fine. You are in some serious trouble. Someone turns on the fan, you're in orbit. And people are walking around with T-shirts that say, go hike the canyon. Why don't you go home and smoke in bed, would you please? They're selling stuff like seaweed. Seaweed? I go to the beach. I see seaweed in the water. I don't even go in. Now you want me to eat this stuff? I have a better idea. Why don't you come over to my house? I'll let you mow my lawn. You can eat the piles. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Holy crap. Holy crap. That is fucking... I literally, as I'm sitting through this, I'm like, that it's in rote. But you know what's amazing is... You know what's amazing is those... That is pacing... That I borrowed from when I first started stand up.
Yeah.
Like that is pacing. I got like that cadence you have.
Yeah.
Is it's almost indoctrinated, and every guy that learns how to write a joke is almost watching.
Yeah. Well, you know what it was? A lot of it was the atmosphere you developed in the Boston atmosphere. I don't know how many times you played there.
A couple times.
But it was a very fast, the style that was developed was a very fast paced style. You had to be ahead of the audience. There was guys like Don Gavin and Lenny Clark and Sweeney, and you know, even Steve Wright had like one joke after another. There was not a lot of setup time. There was not a lot of dead time, you know, and his, of course, he was completely different, but completely brilliant, but it was just a different thing. And the audiences were, it was basically bar rooms, you know, and they say, let's try this and put a microphone in there. So a lot of the rooms were like that you really had to be on top of the audience and ahead of them and keep them laughing because it was easy to lose them.
No, but in for people that claim to be comedy fans that listen to podcasts, I don't think they understand that these were bar rooms. They weren't comedy clubs.
Right, right.
At this point in comedy, there was no such thing as... I mean, I guess the improv was probably in New York.
Right. Improv was in New York, the late 70s, I believe, and the comedy store was in L.A., and there were... you know, a handful of rooms, real rooms. But even when Leno started in the 70s, he started in Boston, there were no comedy clubs. He used to work the Naked Eye strip joint in the Combat Zone.
So when you say like a comedy scene, it literally is almost like the Revolutionary War. A bunch of like-minded gentlemen who got into an idea of this is what I want to do. There's nowhere to do it. And you're the founding in the founding fathers of that scene.
Yeah, well, Barry Crimmins actually came to Boston. He had been in, he was from Skaneateles, and he's actually the star of a new film that Bobby Goldthwait just made, Call Me Lucky, great film. I recommend it highly. Barry came to Boston. He had done a lot of radio in with Goldthwait, and he had done some comedy in upstate New York. Him, Goldthwait, Tommy, what's his name? I can't remember. I'm blanking on his name. Goldthwait's great friend, Tomcat.
Yeah.
Tomcat. I'm blanking on his last name. Anyway, the voice of SpongeBob.
Yeah.
Tom Kenny.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you know, it's so funny. I think I sat at a table and had dinner with him one night.
Yeah.
But I didn't, I was unaware of who I was sitting next to.
Yeah, yeah. But those guys, Goldthwait and Kenny, started in high school. They were like teenagers. Crimmins was probably 23, 24. And Crimmins wanted to do comedy. And he was real the visionary. And he came to Boston and he founded this place called the Ding Ho. It was a Chinese restaurant in Inman Square. I grew up like two blocks from the place. That's how I fell into it. But anyway, Crimmins started it, and all these people who wanted to try comedy started coming out of the woodwork. Stephen Wright was at Emerson. Dennis Leary was at Emerson. Paula Poundstone, Mike Donovan, Mike McDonald, a lot of, you know, the early kind of founding fathers of it. And they had 5, 10, 20 minutes, you know. And then the Comedy Connection was all Paul Barkley and Billy Downs was actually...
I played their one a couple times.
That was Boston proper. And that was just like one little room. And so anyway, that's how the scene started. And so, and it was, you're right, it was bar rooms. The Ding Ho was formerly the Oaks Cafe, which was a place that my best friend Dave Parsons, his father was the bartender there, and it was one of the first places we ever got to drink in because we were, you know, it was like in the early 70s and the drinking age just turned 18, so you could go in there. But it was a men's bar is what it was. And then it became the Ding Ho, was a Chinese restaurant. So anyway, you're right. There were just basically places that were trying out the comedy, and then some places really established it, like the Comedy Connection became a comedy room, and the Ding Ho became a comedy club, and then other clubs opened up in the Boston area, Stitches and Nick's and Played Against Sam's, where Barry Katz started booking.
Yep.
And that was all between 80 and 79 and 82, 83.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and so the scene developed out of there, and people didn't know what they were doing, but the nice thing about, it's like a podcast. You can have your podcast be anything you want, and the territory's wide open. Very similar to early stand-up. There was no rules, especially being in a non-industry town like Boston. You know, the F-bomb was everywhere. Lenny, I mean, it was very unusual for people to be dropping the F-bomb in public. And so people were like amazed by it, and they loved it. It was just, really hit home with the audiences, and the audiences just came out of the woodwork.
With where you see comedy these days with political correctness, where, and like you can tell when someone crosses the line these days on stage and everyone's like, whoa, that's edgy. Mm. What was edgy back then? Like, do you remember
what was edgy? You know, I don't know if anything was too edgy because there was, it was a pretty wild scene. You know, it was,
seems like
Lenny was like the kind of the spearheading it. So, and he was very edgy. You know, Lenny was very edgy and he was, you know, he was good, great with hecklers and, you know, oh yeah, fuck you, fuck that, fuck your mother. I mean, he was like, he was like crazy like that. And so people were, you know, pretty taken back by it. But it also, you know, it's a double-edged sword. You develop that and it's hard for TV. Back then, there's not cable. It's hard to do 5 minutes for national television. You know, it's hard to get a set together. So people kind of developed on their own thing, but nothing was too edgy because the whole thing was so fresh. There was no real barriers. I mean, Richard Pryor was like sort of the gold standard, and Rodney Dangerfield, and you know, of course, Lenny Bruce and George Carlin, those guys. You know, so there was that kind of level of, oh, this is what it could be, you know, in terms of comedy. But, you know, after Richard Pryor's special came out in the early 80s, man, people were just blown away by that 1 hour special. And so everything was open. You know, it was fair game. Everything was fair game.
Did you contemplate moving out to LA at that time? Were you like, it's because all I know about the Boston scene is having played in Boston is the crowds were electric. Like when you got in, it's almost like they held you up to a standard you weren't ready to be held up to. And I remember hearing stories like Colin Quinn going up to Boston for his first time and being terrified.
Yeah. 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 You know, Colin actually became a good friend. And you were following very strong acts. Like back in the day, the way they would host a show, the host was usually the strongest act on the show.
That was the same in New York. And then I came out to LA and it was like, oh no, the host sucks. Everyone else doesn't want to host. And I was like, oh, that makes no sense. I was like, I'll host in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Hosting's great because you get stage time, you get to try things, and when it's not working, you bring up the next guy, right? All right, that didn't go so well, but this next person's hilarious, you know? But you got all this stage time. So, but like, for example, in the Ding Ho or the Comedy Connection, everybody, the headliner was the host. So Lenny Clark had a night. Don Gavin had a night. Steve Sweeney had a night. DJ Hazard had a night. Barry Cremins had a night. Jack Gallagher. The only guy that never hosted was Steve Wright because he was so different and he really wasn't the host type. But that's how we started. And so that you got a lot of stage time, but you had to follow the host. So you didn't have like somebody who had been doing it a year, you know, hosting, and then somebody who's been doing it 3 years, middling for 20 minutes, and then somebody who's doing it 5 or 6 years or 10 years, whatever, headlining. It was more like the guy who's been doing it 5 years is the headliner. He's really good. He's going to open with a strong set, and the next act has got to do 20 to 25 minutes, and they have to be strong, and the next act has to be just as strong as those two, and the final act has to be just as strong. So there was a very even-tempered show
for
the most part.
Now, was it every night? Were you guys doing it every night, or was it just weekends?
About.
Really?
Well, initially it was not every night, but what happened is the open mic scene developed on the Wednesday nights. Lenny Clark had an open mic night on Wednesday nights, and that scene was great because they put like 20 people on, and all you had to do was show up and sign a list to get on.
Yeah.
And you could go up and do 5 minutes, and, you know, that was... that was really almost driving the scene in a certain sense because everybody could get up there and, you know, try. You could try. There was opportunity. That's the great thing about stand-up comedy, man. It just was an organic thing that came out of nowhere. It was unplanned from what I can tell. And it was like true meritocracy in terms of getting on stage and getting laughs. And that's what you had to do.
That was the Boston scene. The Boston scene is – and I don't know if I'm regurgitating what I've – heard said a million times, or if it's what I feel from watching and reading and just witnessing it as a kid, but it seemed like men. Like, it was men. It wasn't, and nothing was too precious. Like, it seemed like everyone
That's
took chances.
Yeah.
Not sexist. I mean, not like in, like, there's no women. I'm saying, like,
there were a few men
that would punch. It wasn't, like, artsy. It was, like, men that would sit at a bar and make men laugh. You know, like, that's what I always got that vibe of, like,
I think that was true. It was very male dominated. There were some women that came out of there that were great. Paula Poundstone.
Oh, Paula Poundstone's fantastic.
Yeah,
but
she came out of there.
But
Lauren Dombrowski,
like,
another friend of ours who has since passed, a wonderful, wonderful woman and great comic. She came out of there. But yeah, it was, but the scene, I think stand-up comedy in general, like many other professions, were dominated by men, whether it's lawyers, doctors,
I didn't mean it. I misspoke. It was, it wasn't guys wearing scarves.
Yeah.
It was guys who had rough hands.
Yeah.
I felt like the comedy scene in Boston, and that's what I think.
I would say, you know, blue collar, mentality, a lot of it. But then there were people like, you know, Steve Wright and Leary, who went to Emerson, and Leno, who understood the concept of stand-up comedy, who understood performance arts, who understood that.
Yeah.
But not everybody did. But the thing about Boston is an interesting town. It's, you got this great academic influence.
Yeah.
You got this historical influence, right? Going back to the Pilgrims and stuff. And you got this political influence with the Kennedys, and it's a progressive state, you know, for the most part. And you got these comics who were just, you know, we had people from who grew up in Cambridge and didn't go to Harvard, like myself and Lenny, and, you know, Sweeney, who grew up in Charlestown and working class neighborhood South Boston, where George McDonald and his brother Warren were from. And so you had this, you know, working class blue collar sensibility, and the audiences were the same way. You go into the audiences and you'd see maybe there's like a table from MIT, and then there's a table from South Boston, and then there's a table from Charlestown, there's a table of Harvard students, you know? So the audience had a lot of diversity in terms of the background as well.
What a great way to develop talent is to be around crowds that are all literally a melting pot of intelligence, of work, of what they do.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, and there was a guy, Jonathan Groff. You might know him. I know he's done really well out here in Los Angeles, but he was a comic who was at Harvard student at the time, was coming down and doing sets at the Ding Ho. And so one of the ways people advanced was to get your own show, whether it was hosting an open mic night or like so, you know, I was – eventually, I actually became the daytime bartender at the comedy club. I fell in love with it. The first time I saw it, I said, wow, here are all these people in their 20s who are making stuff up, completely making stuff up, going on stage and getting a reaction from the audience. And it was like something I had never seen before. And I completely fell in love with the scene. I became obsessed with it. I said to Barry Cremins, I said, listen, you know, I did one open mic. I said, do you got anything jobs here? You know, I'll do anything. I'll sweep the floor. So I became the daytime bartender and the janitor and, you know, whatever needed to be done, which was wild.
All to get stage time.
To get stage time, but also to meet these comics and, you know, just immerse yourself in the scene and watch everybody. It was
pretty wild. Great feeling. And I hope everyone gets to feel that once in their life, is to be so passionate about something.
Yeah.
I worked the door at Barry's club, the Boston Comedy Club.
Did you?
I worked the door and barked. And I have social anxiety.
Good for you, man.
So like getting out in the street and being like, hey brother, you want to see a show?
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Because you came up like I came up.
Yeah.
And that's like the best way. It's like the equivalent of working in the mailroom when they talk about, you know, the show business folks who become the head of some studio. Like, he started in the mailroom in 1931, you know?
Oh, I mean, to this day, people, you know, it's like, I got to see everyone's real personality.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I was talking to someone the other day about Jim Norton, and I don't see Jim on Opie and radio anymore. I don't see him as that guy. I just see him as the same guy who was smoking cigarettes back in the day.
Yeah.
Who would just bullshit and wasn't trying to impress and was just hanging out.
Yeah.
Patrice, Jim, Bob Kelly.
Yeah.
Like all those guys, I think it was a great way to come up. I'm really. What's interesting to me is that you took a route that I feel like nowadays is the standard route for everyone, but you did it on your own, which is the one-man show. Like, I feel like nowadays, everyone's trying to do a one-man show in their act.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you go see guys and it's more long form.
Yeah.
But you took that route for yourself.
Well, what happened was, you know, I was doing the scene, doing, you know, the clubs and everything, did Star Search, did the Tonight Show with Johnny, and...
How was the payoff after that? Did it change your career?
It did. I got an agent, I got a manager, it put you on a... It definitely, I got work around the country, but my passion at the time was, you know, I just started going really in a political direction, politics and social commentary. That's what I was kind of passionate about, you know, and I sort of left when I was drinking, and I quit drinking in 88, and so
really,
yeah, and that
so
was
you've been sober for
I've been sober for a while, and that was awesome because that put my, you know, my a lot of my act was, you know, we should drink more, we should work out less and drink more. That was like my act in the early 80s.
Yeah,
it just was, and it killed. Because everybody in the bar is going, you're right, brother.
And the bars love you. They're like, fucking bring this guy on.
Exactly. But when you get sober, for me, it just didn't work anymore. It wasn't authentic anymore. Yeah. Worked for a time. It wasn't authentic. But what was authentic is, you know, reading and trying to keep up with what's going on in the world and just taking that, you know. And so to your point, yeah, the Tonight Show was great, but it wasn't greatly appreciated on the Tonight Show. I did one. Johnny gave me the big okay. The producer said that was excellent. Start working on another one, but they never had me back.
Really?
And because it was heavily political. It was, and some of the issues I was talking about back then, they're still talking about now. May I give you one of them?
Please.
I'm on the Tonight Show with Johnny. He's sitting over there. The other guest is Bob Hope, okay? So I'm saying, I'm going to give you two jokes, right? So I said, so I'm reading, folks, that Congress just voted against a 7-day waiting period to buy a gun. Now,
holy crap.
This is the Brady Bill, right? Back in the day, right?
Holy.
This is, I said, Now, I don't want to sound like a Quaker, okay? But is a week a long time to wait to see if Hinckley is qualified to own a gun? I said, are people in that much of a hurry to get a gun that they're walking into gun shops saying, hey, I am an American, I pay my taxes, I'm in an argument, I want a gun, I want it now. Just hold on, pal, just hold on. You're going to have to fill out a form. You're going to have to wait at least a week for the gun. A week? The guy will be gone in a week. I want to shoot him now. I mean, a seven-day waiting period to buy a gun and Congress is against it. Come on, will you, Congress? It takes 8 days to get a phone.
It takes 8 days to get a phone.
And at the time, it did. At the time, they would say, I want a phone. Stay in the house. The guy will be at your house within
God
a week.
Damn, I remember that.
You know what I mean? And so that was one line, but it wasn't that popular. I mean,
but think of what side of history you're on. And now you start looking at everything shaking down.
Right.
I'm trying to put my head around what gun arguments must have been like in the 80s.
Well, it was the same. It's very similar arguments. But, you know, the Brady Bill was named after Brady.
He got shot.
Brady, who's Reagan's bodyguard, who got shot. And John Hinckley, obviously, a huge loophole in the law, a mentally disturbed guy, goes into a pawn shop, gets a gun, shoots the president.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but they had to fight 8 years to get the Brady Bill finally become law, with to have a 7-day, you know, a background check on weapons. And it's prevented millions of people from getting weapons because of that thing. And then one of the other jokes that I did that, you know, it was pretty at the time, maybe a little bit on the edge. I don't know. But the Iran-Contra issue was, you know, this big scandal happened with the Reagan administration saying that Reagan had traded arms for hostages, had made a deal when Jimmy Carter was still president, made a deal with the Ayatollah to trade them arms for hostages, and then the hostages would be released the day he became inaugurated. So, and the scandal didn't break till like the mid 80s. And so, and the trial is going on. It's December of 1988. I'm on Tonight Show with Johnny. There's Bob Hope, and I'm saying, so I'm reading that between Ronald Reagan and George Bush, between the both of them, they still cannot remember whether or not they sold guns to Iran. Mr. President, with all due respect to the White House, in the future, if you sell guns to people that take Americans hostage, jot it down. Right? And the place went crazy. Yeah. And that was the last thing I said on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Because they probably knew Reagan personally.
I'm sure Bob Hope did.
I'm sure Bob Hope did.
Did some golfing with the Reagans and the Bushes. Yeah. But anyway, so when cable happened in Comedy Central, the reason why political satire exploded the way it did partially is because there were venues where you weren't tethered to network television standards. And I'm not just talking about swearing. I'm just talking about content.
Content. Yeah, there was a famous story about Johnny Carson's son had committed suicide.
Oh, really?
And then, and there was this comic who had a joke. I remember the joke. I remember the joke to this day. I heard it in my bed. And I only heard about this, I think, through a book I read recently. But that they had said to him, don't tell the joke about suicide. And he's like, yeah, but it's my closer. It's the best bit I have.
Yeah.
And the joke was, I don't think I could commit suicide. What if you pick a building that's too tall, and when you scream, you don't have enough screams? So you jump, and you're like, ah! Like, I think that was the joke, and he never got asked to go back on The Tonight Show. And I guess back then it was like one of those things where you're just like, well, fuck, you've done it.
Yeah.
You know, but now, like,
yeah,
if you didn't play by his rules, you didn't.
Yeah, I don't know when. I don't know what year that was, but when I did it, they really vetted the set. You know,
really?
Oh yeah, because you had to. You know, I used to open with the Iran-Contra joke, and Jim McCauley, and the producer, goes, "You can't open with like a joke about the president. You got to open."
What's
with
so funny is that, you know, they made jokes about the president all the time, but I guess anything that was serious, they didn't want to.
I don't know. You know, Johnny had the license, and the hosts have the license because, yeah, they'll make something about the president, but then they'll make something about Congress, and then they'll make something about, you know, the Democrats, and then something about the Republicans or whatever. But you don't have that license necessarily when you're the comic, at least at that time. But what I was saying is, like, when Jon Stewart and Colbert were able to do, you know, the show on Comedy Central, they could, you know, they had complete artistic freedom. You know, do whatever, and the audience, it resonated so much with the audience.
Now, were you one of the people that, because I remember when I started, there were people that seemed to have plans of how they wanted their career to go.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the whole thing was, do a development set, get to Montreal, perform in front of Montreal, get a deal, have a sitcom.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. My plan was, after I did The Tonight Show, I just obsessed about getting back on. They didn't want it, but I wanted to do that type of material. And I didn't want to do it in the clubs. They quit drinking. It was difficult to perform in the clubs. It's a different mentality.
Yeah.
The people are, it's date night. You know, they're having a good time. And I just was, but I saw Jackie Mason perform in 89 off on Broadway. And he did a show called The World According to Me. And Jackie Mason had been in the Catskills for years. He was, you know, he had done Ed Sullivan back in the 60s. And he actually was not asked back from Ed Sullivan. And I don't know what happened. But anyway, he just honed his craft and just did his thing for years in the Catskills. And he came to New York and had a one-man show on Broadway. And it was not like a Spalding Gray one-man show or Eric Bogosian or John Leguizamo where they're doing characters.
Yeah.
And they're, it was stand-up. And I said, I walked out of that place high because I watched a guy do 90 minutes into a packed Broadway house. People were paying a lot of money to see him. He was hilarious, and he was doing exactly what he wanted to do. And I said, I know what I want to do. That's what I want to do.
Really? So
I just locked into that. You know, I just never went the sitcom route. I didn't care that much about it. It wasn't appealing to me. Movies weren't that appealing to me. You know, which in retrospect, you know, it would be nice to have a long career of
We've done
sitcoms.
A bunch of acting.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. But I mean, not every, you know, people have different motivations, what gets them up in the morning, what they're passionate about. And that was what I was passionate about, and I just kind of went in that direction and just, you know, did that. And And a lot of times it was difficult to get the one-person show because the venues didn't exist for it. You know, it's a theater thing. So it's not like a comedy club where you go where there's an audience already there.
Yeah.
And a theater, there's an empty theater, and you got to put people in it. So I got in the habit of renting theaters and producing the shows. Do it yourself, you know, and rent the theater and you know, get the people in there. And I did it off Broadway in New York with Jack Rollins, Woody Allen's manager and Letterman's manager, and one of the great, great managers of all time, sweetheart of a man, passed away this year at 100 years old. Wonderful guy.
Wow.
Yeah, but he worked with me in New York and came out of retirement to help me, and we rented the American Place Theater in New York and did a one-man show there, and then from there got nice reviews and the New York Times and some other papers, and was able to take that around and went up to Boston and basically rented a theater, the Hasty Pudding Theater at Harvard, and rented that out. And that brought in a whole new audience.
Really?
You know? Yeah, because you have all these Harvard people who go to theater. You know, and I grew up in Cambridge, and we grew up a mile from the Hasty Pudding. No one in my neighborhood knew where the hell it was. So, but it was awesome because you're doing four shows a week, making more money than I ever made doing stand-up because you're producing it. That means you're taking the risk. You're renting it out. You're hiring the publicist, buying the ads, doing the radio, hiring the tech people. You know, it's all your money.
Holy cow.
And then performing it. And I'm working with this wonderful director who I'm actually going to see out here later on today, Larry Arick, who was just a fabulous guy who worked with me. He was Irvin Arthur's cousin, actually. And Irvin Arthur's a great agent here. The Irvin Arthur Agency. But that was one of the great things that became out of The Tonight Show, getting an agent like Irvin Arthur.
Yeah.
You know, who could book you around, book you up in Montreal and things like that. But so a lot of it's been, you know, just being passionate about what you want to do. And the one-man show route was the route I wanted to go.
Now, how do you develop from, how many one-man shows have you done? I want to say six?
Three or four.
Four?
Yeah.
Now, how do you go from writing one-man show to the next? Do you do that? I mean, it's been popular, like Louis and Bill Burr have been like, scrap everything, start all over.
Yeah.
Which is cathartic. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a little stressful for
very admirable.
Guys like us who are not Louis and Bill.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, hey, man, like people come to your shows and they're like, how come you're telling, I heard that joke last time you're here. You're like, yeah. But I also told like 45 minutes worth of new stuff.
Right.
I'm not Bill and Louis. I'm not putting out hours every year.
Right.
But is that how you go about doing a one-man show? Do you sit down and write it out? Like,
you know, for me, it developed out of stand-up, and the first one was Uncommon Sense, and that was largely about quitting drinking and the social issues of that day at that
what
time.
What made you quit drinking?
You know, the last year, people that I was, associates started dying, people I was hanging out with, and suicide, murder, overdose, and these are all people who were in the scene indirectly in my realm of, you know, sphere of influence. And it was a, you know, and people, good people, I mean, people going to jail and getting busted, and it was a bad scene, you know, you know, alcoholism, you know, it just was a downward kind of a spiral after a while. It was fun. No, I mean, I don't take anything, I don't regret all that. I mean, it was a lot of fun stuff. But if you got the disease of alcoholism, it doesn't get better. It kind of gets worse over time.
Yeah.
And more jackpots and problems and trouble. And this is the feeling of waking up. And even though you're doing really well in comedy, you can still be feeling horrible about yourself the next day, about trying to piece together the night. Where did I go after the gig? How much did I spend? Where's the car? Who did I talk to? What did I say?
Yeah.
Where the hell am I? You're waking up in strange places.
Yeah.
Sometimes waking up in jail. You know, and it was just bad. It was just a bad, personally. And so I just wanted to get better. And, you know, you mentioned Colin Quinn earlier. Colin, you know, was one of the guys, was the first guy who said to me, him and Barry Katz actually said, you know what, you could be really good at comedy if you quit drinking. He said, you could be really good at it. And it was really, because deep down inside you felt like you could be good, but to hear it from one of your peers who really didn't, wasn't trying to get you, it was not like a girlfriend saying, you got to quit drinking, you know, or your parents or something. It was like one of your peers saying, man, if you quit drinking, you could be really good at what you do. And that was very appealing, to actually fulfill my potential as an entertainer, as a comic, as a writer. You know, that was hugely appealing because, let's face it, you know, there's a lot of people who, in any kind of field, sports, entertainment, whatever, who you know could have been superstars, and they went down a different road, and they never fulfilled the potential on the field or on stage or whatever. And I just did not want that to happen.
I think a lot of people get caught up, myself included. I've always been a big drinker.
Yeah.
But I get caught up in just having those drinking late Saturday shows be the norm.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, I did a week in Irvine this, like, last week.
Yeah,
last week. And I don't drink because I'm driving back and forth. Yeah. And I don't drink and drive.
Yeah.
And I had fucking monster sets.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, man, you just get lazy. And it's like, and you know, and a lot of it isn't just the drinking. It's just being hung over the day.
That's right.
When you got to do your early Friday show, and there's nothing more depressing than an early Friday show where you're like, where it's a little tighter of a crowd, and then you're like, and you just feel shitty from Thursday night because it's a one show night. So I look at it like a football game.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said to myself, you know, if I want just what you said, and I said, if I want to be the best comic I can be,
right,
I gotta focus on the stand up.
Yeah,
and you know. I think you get caught up in also people, you assume what people think of you, and they want you to be a drinker.
Yeah.
And they want
it's
to
very
do shots
hard.
With you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's hard because, I mean, I don't know about you, but it was my identity largely. You know, it's, you're hanging around with your friends and everybody's in the kind of the same boat. It was really hard to quit. But, man, I went to detox in 87.
I went
several times in 87. I wanted to quit. When I started going to funerals for people that I was hanging out with, and it was not ending well, and I was going on a downward spiral, I said, I need to get help, man, because... So I just called a bunch of places. I went in, stayed for 3-4 days, got out. I could never get like time together. I could never get like a week, 10 days. I just couldn't do it, man. So the last time I went into detox at Christmas of 87, and I got out and I moved to New York, and I just started hanging around with people who were doing the same thing. I hunted down Colin. Started hanging around with him and just trying to do the right thing and focused on the work.
Colin doesn't drink.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't drink, but and just focused on the work. You know what I mean? And just focused on doing stand-up at Catch. And at that time, you know, Seinfeld was there and Rock and, you know, Dennis Miller. And I mean, all these, Larry David and Roseanne and Brett Butler and Colin and Leary and Hicks. And we were all at that time in that scene, and those people were, you know, for the most part, were very serious. In New York and L.A., the people are more serious. My impression, compared to the Boston scene, they were there for the industry. They made a concerted effort to move to New York or move to L.A. to do their thing and to try to fulfill their potential in whatever way they want. So that was, And so it was easier to kind of slide in and fit in with people on that level, you know?
Yeah, it's Boston always had a had like, I don't even know where I'd come up with this, but I always felt like Boston had like a, hey, this is what we do.
Yeah.
We go out, we do stand up, we drink all night. Yeah. We're regular people. And New York definitely, like when I moved to New York, I definitely was blown away by guys that were like focused, real focused.
Yeah.
I mean, I sometimes think people forget how focused Colin Quinn has been for as long as he has.
Right.
I mean, he's still in the fucking clubs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's doing a lot of what you're doing is the one-man show.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So your first one's about sobriety and getting sober.
Yeah, it was Uncommon Sense and that and reenacting a couple of sets on TV. And it was cool. You know, it was just a great vehicle to do it. And I made more money doing it. And I was in an atmosphere that was conducive to creativity. And it didn't have to be bang, 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 bang.
You could let it breathe.
You could let it breathe. Like, it wasn't like the Star Search 2 minute, bang, 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 bang. You know, it was like, you know, this is a thing about homophobia. And this is a thing about racism. And this thing about quitting drinking. This thing about spirituality. And this thing about foreign policy, you know.
Where do you get this sensibility, though? Everyone assumes that Boston's filled with racists. Like, I think everyone always assumes that Boston is this, like, dude, let me tell you something. I just did a Bobby Kelly impression.
Yeah,
but you have such a liberal viewpoint from a time when being liberal was not popular.
Yeah, it's not a racist town. I mean, look at this. There's prejudice everywhere. You know,
I agree wholeheartedly.
But I think. Part of the reason was when they did forced busing in Boston, it was on the news. And it was on the news just like Little Rock, Arkansas, when they desegregated the schools there, or in with George Wallace in the doorway in Alabama, right, preventing black students from going to whatever college it was. I forget what it was right now, but he was in this, or it might have been even a high school.
Huh? I think it was Alabama or Auburn. I know what you're talking about, though. Yeah,
yeah. And that seeps into the national consciousness. And I think that's part of it. Plus, it is a city of when they forced, you know, white neighborhoods to, they were busing kids from white neighborhoods into black neighborhoods and kids from black neighborhoods into white neighborhoods. And there was resistance. It was like a huge thing. Imagine your kids getting on a bus and going to a strange neighborhood when there's a school 2 blocks away. Now you got to go to a school, you know, 2 miles away in a different neighborhood just so there's, you know, racial parity. And, you know, it brought out the worst in a lot of people, a lot of fear. And it was intellectually, it's the right thing to do. You want to move the country forward in terms of immigration. But like any policy, when you force it on people, there's resistance.
Yeah.
And there was resistance. And so that was on the news all the time. But that's why I think people think that about Boston. Not to say there isn't still problems. And I think it comes down to individuals and what's in their own hearts and what their willingness is to change their attitudes. You know, I mean, most people go through a lot of changes. And what you might have thought when you were 15 and what you think when you're 45, it might be two different things around race or any of that stuff.
I was just saying, I got to do a show tonight. They do a show where we tell a story and then sing a song with a band behind us. And I was trying to talk about, like, things have changed so much. I remember being a fan of Jane's Addiction, and Perry Farrell said one time that he blew a dude. And this is back when I was in college, when, like, now you hear that and you're like, whoa, you know, Charlie Sheen, whatever, what happens? But in college, I remember hearing that and going, I remember on the couch, like, sitting back and go, hold on, I love this guy. I love his music. He blows dudes? How am I going to reconcile that? Like, but I mean, things have changed so globally in, like, what, in acceptance and where people's heads
right.
are at.
That's right. Same thing with homophobia, man. We do jokes about that growing up, you know. Talking about, I grew up in this extremely homophobic. Anybody here grow up homophobic? Now, you ask an audience that, nobody will admit it.
Right.
I'm saying, wait a second. I'm the only one that grew up. I admit it. I grew up in a neighborhood. You could be considered gay for anything. The slightest deviation from the norm. You got a haircut. What are you, gay? You know, you didn't get a haircut. What are you, gay? There's a guy in the liquor store wearing sandals. He's obviously a homosexual. My idea of gays, right, growing up was that they were out there hiding in the bushes waiting for me to walk by. They were going to jump out and have sex with me.
Yeah.
And, of course, I get older. You start working theaters. You actually start getting to know and become friends with quite a few gay folks. They assured me, Jim,
The last thing I want to do is hide in the bushes and wait for you to walk by.
One of my first jokes I wrote was in college, and I said, and I just recently started telling it because I didn't know what I was doing, and so I couldn't get it to work. But the joke was, I'm not homophobic. I'm a homochondriac. Like, I don't care if you're gay. I'm afraid one night you'll get me drunk and trick me into it, and I'll like it. That's my fear. But yeah, I think it's really interesting. Where did you go then? Like, what was the progressions of your one man show?
Yeah, so I did that, and you know, none of them, and this is embarrassing to say, but none of them have gone to the level of what I wanted to do with Jackie Mason, you know, because, you know, being your own producer and not really knowing how to produce outside of Boston was difficult. So anyway, I took it to L.A., went from the Hasty Pudding Theater to Los Angeles, did the Coast Playhouse out here, and that was pretty cool in the late 90s. The only thing is, we got great reviews. I'm thinking, okay, we sold out all these shows in Boston. The L.A. people will just come out just like they did in Boston. I'll be able to get on the radio. I'll be getting on local TV. I'll repeat the model, you know. And in L.A., you rent the theater. If you're not famous, it's really hard to get people to come out.
Oh, my God.
You know, and so I had this great theater, the Coast Playhouse. I was there in 98. Great reviews, you know, pick of the week and all that sort of stuff. And L.A. Times, rave reviews. But it was like 20, 30 people a night. I stayed there for 5 months. I kept saying, I know my people are out there. I know they're coming. They never came. They never collectively came. Never,
yeah.
You know, but I did that for like, you know, 4 or 5 months. And El Nino hit the same time. And it was so funny because I'm out there and you're in the Coast Playhouse and they have a tin roof and this rain is just coming down and you can hear the rain on the top. And there's nothing worse than losing money. It's hard enough to play in front of 14 people anyway. Yeah. But it's really hard when you're renting a theater and not only are you losing money, but there's 14 people in there and it's raining out and you can hear the raindrops on the tin roof and as you get prepared to go out that night to go do the gig, the weather people are going, it's going to rain tonight. Don't leave the house. Yeah.
That's the thing about L.A. If it's raining, no one goes anywhere.
Whatever you do, don't leave the house. And if you do go out, don't go to Tingle Show. Let me tell you something. So that was a bitch, but what came out of that, though, was good, and this probably never would have happened if I didn't do that show out there. First of all, got great reviews, got more confidence in the material, but also I saw an article in the newspaper. I was flying back to Boston to do a one-nighter to get some money because it was like $2,500 a week to rent that place $2,500 at the time, the Coast Playhouse. Yeah. And I was, again, producing it myself. And that's the thing about producing. It's a risk. You know, you don't know if you're going to, and we never got the money back. You know, we lost money on it. But what I did get was I'm leaving there and getting nice reviews and everything, but I'm going back and I see this article in USA Today about 60 Minutes. And 60 Minutes, is doing a new show called 60 Minutes 2, and they're doing it on Wednesday night, and they have all the correspondence. They got Mike, you know, Dan Rather, and, you know, what's his name, Scott Pelley, who's now on the air there, and Bob Simon, and they have everybody they need, Mike Wallace. The only person they don't have for the Wednesday show is the Andy Rooney guy. They need somebody to do the Andy Rooney spot.
Yeah.
And they had been putting the feelers out to the industry for months because they were – and I saw the article, and I called Ray Rio, my manager at the time at Brillstein & Gray. I said, Ray, send these guys the tape because I'm perfect for this because I've been pitching myself for that type of a commentary. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Take these comedy bits that were relevant and social and political and just do them to camera to a larger audience. And he sent the tape, and I went down, and I got the job. I ended up getting the job, and so it was the silver lining coming out of that story was basically, you know, things don't happen the way you think they're going to happen, but a lot of times they happen completely out of left field. I never could have imagined a break like that in a million years. It didn't come from management, didn't come from an agent. It came from seeing the article in the newspaper and asking the manager to send them the tape, which he did, and interviewing. And Barry Katz was extremely helpful with that. So I love Barry.
Barry's a really fascinating guy.
Yeah, man.
He really helped a lot with that. Is.
Yeah. Anyway, so got that gig, and that allows you to do, when you do TV, as you know, you can just do more.
Well, what's fascinating about those 60-minute spots was it's one take.
Yeah.
It was one take. It was, I mean, the ones I saw were one take
of
you.
Yeah.
like a man, like man on the street almost.
Yeah.
But you weren't, they weren't chopped up,
right?
Which is so, I don't think people understand that these days, but like these chop cuts that you see on vlogs and on YouTube of kids putting out their, trying to do their Andy Rooney, their 60, their 60 minutes Andy Rooney spot is them editing it over and over. And I, I watched you do one on parking meters, and I thought to myself, that's one take.
Yeah,
there's that's one take. I'll tell you what else is, which I don't think people understand how impressive this is. Your Harvard commencement speech.
Yeah,
that was murderous, but it's like I felt like it was, you were just like, there was no prompter. There, you were just kind of,
there was
riffing.
No prompter. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because the great thing about 60 Minutes was that, you know, it's one take, but you gotta, like, that parking meter routine was right out of my act.
Yeah.
And then I just did it to camera. The problem and the challenge is, okay, now you gotta do 2 minutes next week.
Yeah.
And you gotta do 2 minutes the next week. And then you gotta do 2 minutes a year from now. And it can't, your act is only so long. So you have to write and come up with stuff in a much shorter period of time that is level. Is that the same thing? Like you were saying about creating a new hour every year, like Louis and Bill. Well,
and you're doing it by yourself. You're not John Oliver, who has 15 writers who writes a rant for them.
You got to basically come up with it yourself. Yeah, that's the whole trick.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, that was a big challenge at 60 Minutes. And when I got off of that, I did 2 seasons there, and they were huge, huge break. But what I ended up doing is going back to Massachusetts, starting a theater in Davis Square, Somerville. And I ended up going back to school after the theater closed after 5 years. And that's how I got on the commencement address.
Yeah, you did. You got your, it was your master's?
Got a master's degree, in public policy. Master's of public administration at the Kennedy School of Government, which is a graduate school.
Yeah.
A part of Harvard. And great school, inspiring students. Everybody's there for public policy purposes. You know, you have like people from the like, you got special forces and Green Beret people, and you got people that work with, you know, Amnesty International, the NGOs, and you know, those people. You got the people from the World Bank, you got CEOs, and they're all in there, and they've all been in the workforce, you know, 15, 20 years. They're mid-career people, and they're all there to kind of retool and think about what they want to do. Do they want to continue in that? You know, the military guys were all, and women were all being sent by the military to get their, you know, bring their education level up. A lot of companies were sending their CEOs or their people to bring their education level up. A lot of people who are going into politics, or running for mayor or Congress or governor, were there to get their public policy credentials. I was there. I grew up in the shadow of Harvard. When I closed the theater after 5 years, I didn't want to do it anymore, but I always wanted to go back to school because I grew up there, and people kept saying, you should check out the Kennedy School. And I was saying, there's no way I'll get into the Kennedy School. I, you know, wasn't a really good college student. I wasn't a good high school student at all. This is like, you know, the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
But I applied, and the people there knew.
Because how old were you at the time?
I was 50.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, I went
back
in
my 50s. I'm 59. I'm 60. I'm sorry. I'm 60. And the great, let me tell you this, Bert, the great thing about going back to school in your 50s, you get the student ID and the senior discount. So it's a, it's a beautiful thing. But I got to tell you, I'm in there with all these people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older, and it was just inspirational. You know, a lot of people from other countries, Palestinians and Israelis in the same classroom getting along.
Yeah.
You know, people from Africa going back to really challenging situations in the Congo and the, you know, in Rwanda, and, you know, going back to situations where they don't have running water in some of these places. They don't have electricity. They don't have a healthcare system. So my classmates were going back to help improve those countries. There was a girl in my class from South Africa who couldn't go to school with white people in the 80s before apartheid ended, you know. Really brilliant, brilliant people. And just in good people trying to improve the society.
That, all people should, you know, go to college in their later in life. Like, I believe, like, if I went to school now, there's so much I want to learn.
Yeah.
There's so much I care about.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't care about anything
no
when
one
I was
does.
In college.
Well, not no one, but yeah, you're right. It's a different scene. But when you go back as an adult, I was so motivated, and I just loved it. And I, one of the classes I took, and it was a crazy thing to take this, I took arts and communication. I never studied comedy, never studied theater.
Yeah.
You know, So, and people saying, why are you taking arts and communication? You communicate all the time. I said, you know what? I'd like to actually learn how you do it because I just kind of do it. You start an open mic night. You don't, you know, you're trying to get 5 minutes and you, anyway, I took it. And one of the assignments was to watch the commencement address of Steve Jobs, his commencement address from Stanford University. Yeah. So he does this great commencement address, very inspiring. I recommend it to your listeners. Just check it out because he's talking about his, you know, he's talking about he's been diagnosed with, what did he have? He had some sort of cancer, I thought it was
brain cancer or pancreatic.
Yeah, but whatever it was, you know, he was telling a story about his own mortality and his life and how he, you know, he was basically doing his story about how he got where he was, and it was beautiful. But anyway, and I asked the professor, I said, do they do a commencement address at Harvard? She goes, oh, yeah. Every year they have a competition for it. I said, really? She goes, you should enter it. You know? I said, you think so? She goes, yeah. They've had funny ones. You know, in the past, there's sometimes. Yeah. So I just researched, all right, what do you got to do? And I treated it like a set. I had to write.
Oh.
I wrote a script and go, here's my 6 minutes, right? And submitted it, and like 40 other people submitted it from the School of Law and the School of Medicine, the School of Business, and they whittle it down to 20 people and then 10 people, and then you go in and read it for them, then you go in and read it, then you're off book, and you recite it to them, and they chose me out of these people, and when I started to develop it, I went just like a set, like I was doing Letterman or The Tonight Show. I went to all the clubs. I go, all right, everybody, I'm going to folk clubs.
I'm doing the commencement speech at Harvard. Exactly. Everyone's smart enough for a sec.
I should have said that. But I'm going in there, and that's exactly what I'm doing. I go, folks, I'm doing a commencement address at Harvard in 2 weeks now. Pretend we're all graduating from Harvard. And it's a Thursday morning, right? And so in the set, you know, in a comedy club, it got some laughs, but not like at Harvard,
you
right?
You murdered.
Right. But when I did it at the last night, I was telling Barry this on his podcast, too. The night before, the two nights before I'm doing the Harvard one, I'm in this Cantab Lounge. It's a bar in Central Square, Cambridge, right? It's a gritty bar. They have open mics and blues nights, and they've been there 100 years. And it's like 1:30 in the morning, and it's open mic blues night, right? So like all these blues bands have been on all night, and it's 1:30 in the morning. There's like 18 people left, and 10 of them are hammered, you know, and 9 were in the band, and there's a couple guys at the bar. I go, all right, it's 1:30. Please welcome Jimmy Tingle. All right, everybody, listen. Pretend we're all graduating from Harvard on Thursday morning. This guy's at the bar. Harvard sucks. But it was so much fun. But I treated it like a set. That's why when I got up there, I'm like, I was never so nervous, Bert. I have to tell you, I was so nervous. When, you know, it was like, you know, you're in front of 35,000 people, and the whole Harvard yard is full, and it's like they got a, you know, what do you call it? What do you call it when they got the big screens all around the campus? So in other schools, they're watching it and everything.
Oh, really?
The whole commencement address, and Judge Souter from the Supreme Court's to my right, and Meryl Streep is to my left.
Holy crap.
And all these people, all these Nobel Prize winners are there.
And everyone's in costume pretty much.
Yeah. And everybody's in their gowns, and the audience is like all these Harvard professors from going back 50 years and students. It was unbelievable. And they dug it. They loved it, you know. Yeah. And I was talking about growing up in the city and my story about, you know, growing up there and how much it meant to me going to the school, how much it gives you hope about the school gives you hope, and like anything is possible. The people are positive, and that's what I was trying. That's the point that I was trying to make in the speech, that, you know, anything's possible. If I can get a what did I get, a B minus in statistics or whatever at Harvard, a graduate school, you know, there's hope for world peace. That was my thing.
My wife and I, like, because I think Barry thought you were coming in last week.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, please. And so my wife and I started watching videos one night, and my wife was literally just like, oh my God, the students are laughing as hard as the professors.
Yeah.
And it was like, that was like, you know, so it's so hard to play to everyone and get everyone to laugh. Yeah. The only other thing I have to say is like the best, one of the things that made me rethink comedy was watching your bit about airlines, about getting on planes and Yeah. And has anyone packed your bags? Anyone given you anything? What really blew me out of the water was so often people airlines, and you've been doing stand up since when airline jokes were brand new original.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Literally. But so many people veer away from material, and what I saw was material that had its own thumbprint on it. Like, your material was so you. It was so the bit, I literally howling laughing when you say that, and then they say, "Has anyone given you anything to try? Has anyone given you anything in the last 24 hours?" And you go, "Come to think of it, there was a knock at my door last night.
Last night about 11, I'm getting ready to turn in. The doorbell rings, and there stood a man I never met before. And he says to me, 'Bert, I heard you're flying out in the morning.' 'Why, yes, I am. Will you carry this on the plane for me?' 'Carry this on the plane for you? I don't even know you. What are you going to do for me?' 'Well, I can pack your bags.'"
Well, underwear for Mr. Jimmy?
Yeah.
Socks for Mr. Jimmy? It's such a... But it was so... It was a real, definitive look at how the art form itself is simply your voice. So many people could go... You've heard a joke similar to that where someone just goes, you know, they just don't put their stamp on it. They don't leave their thumbprint on it. But you, listening to you do that, I went, "Oh shit, I'm not working hard enough." Like, that is authentic. That is watching Picasso's
brush stroke. Right.
Yeah, making it. And people go, "Oh, I have an airline joke." Yeah, but it's not like mine. And mine's real and it's brilliant. It's like, I really kind of sat back and I was like, wonder how much material I've dodged or areas I've dodged, and not just maybe had the confidence to say, "Oh, let me just make it mine."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the hardest things is being willing to fail on stage. And Steve Jobs talks about that in his speech about experimentation. You got to experiment with comedy, any new product.
Yeah.
It's a series of... Edison did like 2,500 experiments to get the light bulb, and he finally, you know, he got it. But it's like, so much of it is failure, and it sucks to be on stage and not get the laughs and not do well. It's just the worst feeling in the world, but we got to do it. We got to force ourselves and challenge ourselves to do it.
What do you think you would have done if you hadn't done stand up?
I don't know. I don't know what I would have done.
Do you look back at life and go, you know what I really would have enjoyed was, like, my dad always goes, "I would have loved to have been a teacher."
Yeah.
And I go, "Really?" He's a lawyer.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Yeah, I don't know if I like this."
Yeah. You know, I can see teaching. You know, I was a certified teacher when I got out of school, college. Also politics. I've always thought about going into politics. But I don't, one of the things I got out of the Kennedy School when I was there, that was one of the reasons I went there. I'm thinking, maybe I'll go into politics. But I realized, you wouldn't believe how many times in the classroom the name Jon Stewart would come up, Stephen Colbert, Bill Maher, Leno, Conan, about jokes that people had heard or they had seen or on Saturday Night Live that was addressing the social and political issues of the day in the cultural conversation through entertainment.
Yeah.
And I realized, man, there's very few people that have the ability to be on television, be on the radio, be on your podcast with a social and political point of view. And it's a great, great opportunity. And so many of my classmates are immersed in public policy, doing great work, trying to make the society better in education and healthcare and everything. But they're very rarely on television, very rarely on the radio, very rarely on a podcast, you know, so it's a great opportunity. So what I'm trying to do now is use entertainment for purposes beyond entertainment.
Yeah.
That's why I'm trying.
You've got the nonprofit.
It's a Humor for Humanity.
Humor for Humanity. No, what is that?
Well, what it is I'll give you the pitch, all right?
Okay.
Humor for Humanity, more than entertainment, raising spirits, funds, and awareness for nonprofits, charities, and social causes. Our mission is your mission. Humor for Humanity. Humor in helping. Humor in healing. Humor in hope. Ha, ha, ha. And I came up with it at the Kennedy School because I figured I want to have some sort of a social contribution
but using entertainment to do it. Yeah. And so the model is still being worked out, but it's basically a way to, I'm going to start my own podcast. That's why I'm so grateful for you having me on.
No, of course.
This is an awesome setup. I want to start my own about humor for humanity and have entertainers, and I'd love you to come on mine.
I'd love to.
At some time when you're playing Boston, and maybe talk about maybe one of the nonprofits that you support.
I'm a big fan of Operation Smile.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Operation Smile.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Jude.
Yeah. I'd love to come on and talk about that and maybe just raise that awareness, because a lot of the nonprofits, they're all struggling for stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's just a contribution. I'd like to do my own podcast, maybe my own TV show around that and interview people. And so that's like what I can do, you know, as a performer and as a comic, and make it funny but interesting, and hopefully have some follow-up calls to action with it.
It'd be cool if you could get comics... if you could almost like get comics to do on their weekends, do an extra show, like do one more Sunday night show, and donate the proceeds to charity,
right?
Like make it across the board where it's like the, you know, Sunday, if you want to do one more thing, it's just it's a fun show. If people want to come out, they, you know, something.
Yeah.
I always feel like I sometimes get caught up in going, I want to help. How do I help?
Yeah.
You know, like we did a benefit when I was in Montreal for people, I don't think it was in hospice, but people dealing with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And you get like, they give you the call, and it was Zoe Friedman, Bud's daughter.
Yeah.
Was the one, I think, that reached out to me, and I, of course, I'm like, oh yeah, of course. But then it starts leading up to it. You start getting nervous, just like, well, shit, what material am I going to do?
Yeah.
Like, and then she's like, don't worry about it. Just have a good time. And then you get out, and it was like me, Alonzo Bowden, Jimmy Carr, Gina, Sharon, and like it was a bunch of
strong acts.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa, shit.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I watch everyone destroy, and I'm like, all right, now I got to do good. And it's so stressful.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of guys would do more if they just had, if it's made easy in a weird way. I think a lot of guys would like to try to help out.
Yeah.
How does your stand-up differ these days when you say you're doing the Wilbur New Year's Eve, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You're doing the Wilbur New Year's Eve. Do you do stand-up? Do you do more of a one-man show? Do you do a hybrid?
Yeah, I do a hybrid. And because it's New Year's Eve, people are in the mood that, you know, it's going to be a lot of things that happened this year, you know.
Oh, kind of like a recap?
A little bit, yeah, but also older material, you know. Stuff that works and that's relevant. You know, for example, I mean, guns are in the news, and I have gun bits back years.
You've got gun bits back.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But also stuff on, you know, what's happening this year. And I have stuff on immigration back in the day that's still relevant. And
what?
So making things fresh, because what you realize is you stick around long enough, the same issues come up and up and up over and over again. And a lot of them don't go away, unfortunately. So, but to make it new, make it fresh, and be funny. That's the thing. It's like Woody Allen said, if I make people laugh, that's great with my movies. If I make them think, that's tremendous. But if I make them laugh and think, that's fantastic. But if I just make them think, I'm in trouble.
So what do you think about Donald Trump?
what do I think about Donald Trump? I think he's hitting a nerve with a lot of disaffected people. And I think a lot of it is false, what he's saying. There was a big article in the Times, the Sunday Times, New York Times, and they did a survey of the presidential candidates and whether or not they were accurate, their statements. And Donald Trump's 76% of the statements he's made are inaccurate. 76%. Yeah, check out the Sunday Times, yeah. And they're false statements, but people say it all the time on television. People say things that aren't true all the time. They imply, they infer, you know, like, the Democrats just want to let the illegal aliens across the border. They just welcome them in here, you know, and that's like not true, but people say it all the time. Or they say the Republicans want to, you know, destroy Medicare or whatever it is, Social Security. And it's not true, but people say it all the time and there's no consequences for it. And anyway, so Ben Carson had 80% of his statements were false, according to this PolitiFact.
Really?
Yes. It's in the Sunday Times in the, it's like, it used to be called the Week in Review section. It's called, I forget what it's called now. But anyway, it was in yesterday's Times. And Hillary was at 28%. Bill and Hillary, like, were the least, the most honest out of the, and that was still at 24% or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's saying that's, and I want to know, like, if my side is, like, bullshitting me about something, I want to know about it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to be, like, just taken to the hoop, you know, of, you know, because I'm going to, I try to help where I can, you know. Obama, I think, was at 26% of his statements were incorrect. And some of it is just you misspeak, but some of it's deliberate, you know, and some of it's deliberate. But Trump with his wall, you know, I'm going to build a beautiful wall with a big gate across the southern border. My point is, when you build a wall across the southern border, guess what? People will go around the wall, okay?
Yeah.
So you got all these, you know, drug, human traffickers, drug dealers, gun runners, whatever.
Wait, was it you that had the joke about art picking lettuce?
Yeah. That was from Conan back in the day.
That was back in the day. The bit was, they're, ladies and gentlemen, they're doing triathlons to get here at night.
Yeah. Actually, you look at the risk these people take to sneak into the country. They're doing a triathlon in the dark just to pick lettuce. Think about that. Walk the desert, swim the river, run across the border. First 10,000 get to pick some lettuce. And people say, we can't let these people in. They're taking all of our jobs. What? Are they taking our jobs or are they doing our jobs? When's the last time an American citizen went for a job picking lettuce? Oh, I've never really been happy here at the bank. All these years cooped up in this air-conditioned office, how I've longed for migrant work.
Yeah.
What I'd give to be out in the fields of Arizona when it's 190 degrees, rip off my shirt, down on my hands and my knees, picking a little lettuce. But can I? No. The Mexicans get all the good jobs.
That is...
So, but that was, I did that on Conan in like 98, and it's still relevant. It's, and that's what I mean
about
things.
It's even almost more relevant now.
Yeah, it's more of an issue.
It's more of an issue. It's gun control, immigration. I think they've really, I mean, it's fascinating to me how all that stuff is cyclical.
Yeah.
It feels like, I bet you could write, theoretically, you could write one act about everything and then just wait 5 years and redo it again.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, this is all brand new. I mean, you could destroy
Twitter.
Hey,
that's a good idea, Bert. This man is unbelievable. No, one of one-man shows.
And I'm back, everybody.
That would be fun.
So, real quick, I know I've had you on for
thank you
over
so
an
much
hour,
for having me on.
But besides being a comic, I'm such a massive fan of comedy in general. I feel like I love being a part of the organization.
Yeah.
The subculture is one of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm.
And just talking shop about comics. So if I can, I'll run through a list of comics.
Sure.
Just give me first word that comes to mind.
Sure. But just understand, I might not know who they are.
No. It'll be a mix.
My wife knows more about entertainment than I do. She's like, I come home, she'll be watching, you know, the best shows on HBO and stuff. I go, I can't believe you're watching all this violence. I'm going up the stairs to watch the real news.
Yeah.
Which is more horrifying than anything you can make up. Right?
Yeah. No, it'll be a mix of guys, mostly from
from
your scene, and then some just Boston guys.
But let me just ask you, how long have you been doing it?
16 years.
16, nice.
Yeah.
That's a good time. So you started in what, 90?
I started, started in 97?
97. No,
98?
No. You started in 2000, yeah.
Oh, no, okay. I guess I've been doing it longer.
Yeah.
I started in 98.
Okay.
So cool. I was 26.
Good.
That's the only way I can
That's
do
about
the math.
How old I was when I started.
Yeah, I was 26. I'd left college.
Yeah.
I ended up graduating in New York, having to take correspondence classes. And I had a bunch of hubris about me because I'd been written up in Rolling Stone as the number one party animal in the country. So I thought it was like a big 6.5 page article. So I felt like I deserved stage time, even though I'd only done it once.
Uh-huh.
So I moved to New York and then started working the door at Barry's Club. And then,
Boston Comedy Club.
Boston Comedy Club. And I did that for about a year. I got a deal 6 months into doing stand-up.
Wow.
Through Will Smith.
Wow.
And then moved out here and I started going back and forth for a while. Then got a TV show out here and then just started touring. Toured with, when I was first started out, I worked with Jay Moore a lot.
Yep.
And then just started doing the road, myself headlining. I guess I've been headlining for 11 years. My daughter's 11, and I only know that because when she was born, I started getting gigs at the Laugh Stop in Houston. Did you ever do Laugh Stop?
No.
Houston and Laugh Stop was great. It was Bill Hicks's club.
Yeah.
It was the best. And so I've been headlining for 11 years, and but yeah, I've been in it.
That's great.
It's been, yeah, it's I just was talking with Joe Rogan this week about
I caught half your podcast. It was awesome.
I was pretty fucking out of it.
It was good.
That was a definitely.
It was really good. And I have to tell you, I don't even know, like, when Barry said, come out and do my podcast, I'm saying, all right, I got to catch up on the podcast. Like, what are people doing, you know? So I was listening to Joe. I listened to you. I was listening to Bill. You know, Burr.
Oh, yeah.
His and him and Joe had a nice conversation. That was like 2 hours. I'm like,
oh Joe,
my God.
When you do Joe's, it's 3 hours.
Wow.
It's three
I
hours.
Believe it. It was all over 2 hours. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When you do Joe, I like to keep mine in the hour plus.
Yeah, that's cool.
I want to go over an hour always, but I don't.
Yeah.
Like anywhere around 2 hours, I'm afraid. I mean, I know people love it when they're 3 hours.
Really?
But yeah, like Stanhope and I did. You know Doug Stanhope?
Yeah, I know who
Stanhope
he is.
Stanhope and I did 5 hours.
Wow.
But it was, I mean, we had met a few times.
Yeah,
it was
lunch.
First time. We sat out here and had drinks.
Yeah.
And we drank for 5 hours. We only stopped to go have dinner with my family.
Yeah.
And then come back and redo the. And,
wow.
And it, but it you know, I liked, I personally feel like if, when I start doing 5 hours, the conversation meanders so much that, but Joe's focused. He's one of the godfathers of podcasting.
Right.
So he knows, I mean, he goes there and it's a great 3 hour conversation. It's like, but I mean, one of the reasons I have my podcast, honestly, is so I get to hang out with guys like you.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't get the opportunity if we were at a club. There would be no reason for us to, other than me going, hey, Jimmy, do you mind if I pull your ear for a little bit and ask you a few questions?
Yeah.
Which all comics are accommodating to. But even still, you'd be like, yeah, you know what? I got to get home.
Yeah.
I'm done. I did my set. I'm tired.
Do you like doing it, the podcast?
I do. I'm redefining.
How long you been doing it?
2 years.
Wow.
I've been doing it 2 years at the behest of Rogan. Rogan was like, man, get your own podcast. Your own podcast. And I started doing it. And it just helps people. It really focuses your fan base and gets them to the clubs.
Yeah.
And then you
develop skills, interview skills.
The two things. Well, for me, my interview skills are horrible. I always bring things back to me. I always.
That's all right.
I'm like egocentric in that way. Like, I always want to tell you my story.
Yeah.
Right now, my focus is my podcast and my vlog. I'm really obsessed with vlogging.
And how's that working?
The vlog's how long probably is that? A vlog. The only problem with vlog is I just keep that camera right there with me.
Okay.
I take it with me, and when I do stuff, like if I'm going to do podcasts, I'll bring it with me and I'll shoot the podcast and I'll kind of film my day. December, I've been focusing on weight loss. I've been partying pretty hard for like a year.
Yeah.
Doing on the road, and so December 1st, I was like, I'm home. I'm getting healthy. I can drink if I want to drink.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it is like focused on losing weight. I was 255.
Wow.
And I'm 239 right now. So that's only
that's
like,
good though.
Yeah, it's like two weeks,
that's
week
good.
And
10 pounds, more than 10.
17.
17 pounds. Good for you.
So,
but how long is a vlog? Okay, it's
like I edit them down to like 6 minutes.
Okay.
But I do all the editing. I post it. I'm a little bit
And it's not stand-up, right?
It's not stand-up. Although I'll bring it with me if I do stand-up.
Yeah.
And I'll shoot like hanging out at the club afterwards, talking to comics. I'm doing the show tonight, and I'll bring my vlog camera with me and show backstage, show a little bit of my show. But for the most part, it's what Bill's doing on his podcast, the Monday Morning Podcast, was genius. Is why be... necessitate on guests, just do himself. And so I thought, well, what's the best way to facilitate that for me is a vlog where it's just me. I can put out a product to people that want to watch it, and I'm the only one that needs to make it. I can make it by myself in here. It would be really great for you, especially like it
could do commentary then.
You could do what you did on 60 Minutes and do like 2 minute clips and put them up, and the more, like, if you get on it, you're like, I'm going to do them twice a week, and you put them up every day, people look forward to it.
Where do you post them? Just on
your website? I post them
on YouTube. On YouTube.
I just post them on YouTube, and then...
But how do you get it out?
What do you mean?
How do you distribute it? I mean, once it's up there, it's just...
Once it's up there, you get subscribers to your YouTube page. I put it on Twitter, and then people go to Twitter or Facebook, and they see that, oh, there's a new one, and they click. What ideally you want to do is get into the place where people are excited for your vlog, and they're checking every day. Like, I check... a couple people's vlogs every day where I go, ooh, I wonder what he did yesterday.
Cool.
And click it. These guys do daily vlogs. But the podcast for me really kind of is a great way to centralize your fan base. And when you have a product coming out, like I wrote a book, I go, hey, guys, my book's coming out. Pre-order my book. And then
is it already out?
Yeah.
I got to get it, man.
Right here.
I got to get it.
I'll give it to you.
All right, Bert.
Here, let's make sure I didn't. Oh, there's a sticker in it. Oh, there's stickers all in this book. My daughter's. But yeah, here. This is my book.
Wow.
It's Life of the Party. It's all my crazy stories.
Thank you.
Yeah, I pit it as like my favorite author was Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
And so all I wanted when people read it was to laugh and to be like, hey, man, that was a really easy read.
Yeah.
When I first time read Ernest Hemingway, I was like, seemed like an easy book to read. Like, I didn't get, I enjoyed it. I got through it. But yeah, that's.
Cool, so, man. You have to sign it to me.
Yeah.
Before I leave.
Please. And like I said, I'll post it at the beginning of the show.
But this is so exciting because comics have the opportunity to have their own podcast, their own vlogs,
yeah,
write their own books,
yeah,
and you don't necessarily have to be on television to do it.
You don't need
anyone. And that's what you were asking earlier about, like, what's different. One of the things that's different is there's not just the gatekeepers. I mean, the gatekeepers, because of the technology, there are no gatekeepers. If you can figure out how to do a podcast or a vlog or whatever, you can participate.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing to think that, you know, I've seen how much has changed in my lifetime.
Yeah.
From when you had to go to Montreal to get a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to get a deal to be taken serious. And you had to be in LA. Like, nowadays, it's like, I travel with what would have been $15 million worth of equipment when I started comedy.
Yeah.
I have my own podcast, my own vlog. I put it all on YouTube. I'm doing an interview with someone that literally, and I can put a number on it, 100,000 people, when I post this, are going to go, shut the fuck up. What did Bert and Jimmy talk about? And that will download it immediately. And
really?
It, oh, yeah. And so that, for me...
Hello, everybody. I thought it was just me and Bert.
But like...
JimmyTingle.com. I got a vlog coming out, brother. And a podcast.
I mean, with the people you know, if you started a podcast, and do you live in New York or Boston now?
Boston.
You start a podcast, especially guys coming into Boston that are coming into play Boston, like a Bill Burr, who would gladly sit down with you for an hour and talk.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, it would be, you know, I mean.
Be fun.
I always suggest people to do it.
Yeah.
It's worth trying. Like, when I started my vlog, I was getting 2,000 downloads of a vlog, and it was a lot of effort for 2,000. And then I did one with Rogan. I did Rogan's podcast, and I put the vlog up there, and I had and that one got like 8,000.
How long was it when you put it up there?
Six minutes
of your conversation.
No. Joe? It's just I'll show you when we get done. Okay. I'll show you what a vlog looks like.
I just
posted one today, and then I'm editing the next one. That's the only problem. I wish I didn't do all the work.
Yeah,
but once again, it's neat to know that I can do all the work, but it just.
You know, Mark Maron, he had the president in his garage on his thing, and he goes, and I saw him being interviewed, and he goes, I don't know how the hell it works. I have a guy who helps me. He goes, I can't even upload it to iTunes. I don't even know how it works. He edits it and gets it up there, you know?
Maron was one of the first ones I listened to. Maron was one of the first podcasts I listened to where I was like, it was him and Stanhope talking, and then he had Janine Garofalo on, and I was like, I was on a plane. I was like, get the fuck out. I get to have Mark Maron in my ear with Janine Garofalo.
It's like
they're sitting next to me and I get to eavesdrop.
Yeah.
And I did not know what a podcast was. And I was like, I mean, I knew what it was, I was like, I hadn't heard of a really good one. I just turned my wife on to podcasts because we did one last week. Her book club came over. They had read a book I had happened to read. And I said, ooh, let's podcast your book club and I'll be a part of it. And we'll talk about this book about public shaming.
Yeah.
And so my wife now is obsessed with podcasting.
And that must have helped that book a lot.
Oh, well, it's a pretty big book.
It must have been a bit, yeah, but it must have been a big boon for the book.
I don't know if anyone listened to the podcast, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Only because it's not like people will listen to this because they come to this podcast mostly for me to hang out with comics.
Yeah.
So when I don't have comics on, sometimes they kind of, my fans will go, I don't know who that is.
And you know how many people listened.
Oh, yeah, I get all my numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get all my numbers. Total downloads is well up in the millions.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, no.
Okay, Wilbur Theater, New Year's Eve, everybody. Wilbur Theater, New Year's Eve, JimmyTingle.com.
Those, yeah, like you can, you, I can look from all, I think I've put out 140 podcasts. I can look at all the numbers for all of them and it adds up, you know, well into the millions. It's really fascinating to find out.
That must have blown you away.
No, well, it's been a build. It's, you know, the first time when I put the podcast up, I had, do you know who Joey Diaz is?
Yeah.
I had Joey Diaz on.
Yeah.
And he literally destroyed from beginning to end with my dad. It was my dad and Joey Diaz and me and Tom Segura.
Wow.
And that, I mean, when I watched the numbers shoot up, it was like.
But he has his own.
The first day, it was like 70,000 people listened to it. And I was like, holy shit.
That must be unbelievable.
And then I'm just watching these numbers climb, and I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. And then I had Joey Diaz come. I had him one, you know, because we're friends.
Yeah.
Our families are friends. He comes over one Easter, and I got the podcasting stuff set up in the man cave. And Joey says, turn it on. Let's do a podcast, dog. So my dad's here again, and Joey gives my dad edible marijuana. And my dad is high now. And then
God, and
that podcast skyrocketed. The one with Stanhope is massive. Greg Fitzsimmons is huge.
I got to give Greg a call.
Greg. I was just with Greg the other night. Yeah. I'm trying to get Greg to see if he would help me vet my hour to kind of look at it and see where I'm lazy, where I'm sloppy, where my bad habits
stand
are.
Stand up. Yeah. You mean? Yeah.
Do an hour this coming year, and I.
It's for a special,
for a special.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doing a special. We don't know.
Except for Netflix.
We don't know where it's going to be yet because we're kind of in negotiations with a couple places.
Right.
But
they look at your numbers, right, for your podcast, for your vlog.
Yeah, they do that with the book, too.
To determine whether or not they'll license it, right?
It doesn't. I don't know if podcasting numbers totally translate into television numbers. Mm-hmm. Only because, you know, there's a lot of people I listen to on podcasts, but I don't really like. I'm like, yeah, but that's because it's one of my things that I like.
Yeah.
So it's in my hand.
Yeah.
I say it's like a 3-point shot with your thumb. You're in my hand.
Yeah.
I, when I'm looking for that entertainment in that way, like on a plane or working out, you're my podcast guy. I don't always follow my people I listen to podcasts into their next venture.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think likewise for me, people that listen to my podcast don't always watch my TV show. But, and people that watch my TV show have no idea of a podcast.
Do they come to the clubs when you work?
Two different groups.
Really?
The podcast people come and the people that watch the TV show. But my TV show has always been, you know, family friendly.
Yeah.
And my stand-up's not.
Yeah.
And my podcast's not.
Yeah.
And then now this vlog's like a mashup of both. And it's a brand new set of viewer watching the vlog who listens to the podcast. It is an interesting time. I really only wish I was 10 years younger. Because now that I'm, like, I wish I had done this 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But
it's great, man.
Yeah, it's really been fun. So let's go through. I'll list off a bunch of comics. And just first thing that comes to mind.
All right.
These are the things that I feel like will be the viral clip.
Okay.
I'll put this in my vlog.
All right.
So, Barry Crimmins.
Barry Crimmins, mentor, founded the Ding Ho, great guy, and I wish him all the success in the world with his new film. It's awesome. And Goldthwait is a good man for
making
that
film.
Bobcat, same thing. Bobcat, we started together. We did a comedy competition in 1982. Me, him, and Dennis Leary. Bobcat won the $100. This was in Newport, Rhode Island, right? It was Bobcat won the $100. I came in, some kid that juggled came in second. I came in third, and Dennis, I feel bad for him, he didn't place.
What about Dennis Leary?
He didn't place that.
No, time. What do you think about
Dennis Leary? Good dude. I just saw his what do they call it? Comics Come Home. We were talking about doing charity stuff. They've raised, I think it was $30 million over the last 19 years doing that Comics Come Home. Cam Neely thing. It was at the Fleet Center. It was awesome. Louis was there. I mean, you know, my hat's off to him. He's done his own thing. He's done his own TV shows. He's worked it. He learned how to do it at Emerson. He did it in stand-up. And then he took it to another level with his TV show. And then he's given back with his charity. So it's pretty awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, did you know Dane Cook?
I don't know Dane that well, but I'm glad for his success. I know, this is funny, but I hadn't seen Barry in years. And Barry was in Boston in, I guess it was 2005, maybe 2006. And I called him up. I said, Barry, Dane Cook. I didn't even see him before. I had never seen him work. He sold out two shows at the Fleet Center. I go, how the hell did he do that? He goes, no paid advertisement, right? And I'm like running this little theater with 200 seats. I'm busting my ass to get people in there. I go, how the hell did Dane Cook get sold out two shows? He goes, I'll tell you about it. And obviously he caught the wave with social media early on, MySpace, putting clips out there, giving giving the stuff away, and was way ahead of the game in terms of that.
He's a very inspirational dude in the way he looks at this business, the way he looks at himself, and the way he looks at everything. And one of the things that is kind of notable in similarities between the two of you is he invests in himself. If he's going to do his thing, he puts his own money behind him.
Yeah.
He bets on himself, just like you do with these theaters. And
it's a risk. It's a risk, but you got to. They say, you know, in show business, never use your own money. Well, if I never used my own money, I never would have got a one-man show off the ground, and I never would have been able to do half the things I've been able to do.
That's crazy. Stephen Wright.
Steve Wright. Talk about inspiration. Completely unique. When the Peter LaSalle, the comedy producer for The Tonight Show at the time in the early 80s, came to the Ding Ho. I was the daytime bartender. I gave him directions. His daughter was going to Emerson.
Yeah.
And he had read this article in the LA Times about all these Irish Catholic comedians in Boston. So he set up an audition, and they got the top 10 guys in Boston. And Steve Wright was on the bill, and Peter LaSalle calls the Ding Ho and goes, yes, I'm Peter LaSalle from The Tonight Show. I'm coming there tonight. How do I get there? I go, okay, Mr. LaSalle, what you do is you drive down Cambridge Street. You go through Leechmere Square. You go through Immon Square. When you get to Immon Square, you take a right on Springfield Street, go in the back, go around in the parking lot, and that's the parking lot. But anyway, he saw Stephen Wright, and the next night, he put him on The Tonight Show, or 2 days later, put him on The Tonight Show from this Chinese restaurant, the back room of a Chinese restaurant with this decor right here, right?
Yeah.
The back room of the Chinese restaurant in Nimmin Square, Cambridge, put him on The Tonight Show in two days later, and then put him on again the next night because Johnny was so blown away.
Holy shit.
So Wright put us on the map in Boston largely. He was, and we all watched it. When it was on, we were all in the back room watching Steve Wright kill on The Tonight Show. And he sat down, and Johnny says to him, so you come from Boston, not a lot of comics from Boston. And Wright looks at him and goes, yeah, well, there's some really good ones, and they're all here with me tonight. And we went fucking crazy.
Lenny Clark.
Lenny, the lion. Lenny was the lion in Boston. He was the... he drove the bus a lot. He drove the train largely in that town. He broke down a lot of doors. He made it safe for people to go on stage in a lot of ways because it was rough and there were no rules. And you'd have the neighborhood people, and he took charge of the audience. And hecklers was like a big thing. Everybody was petrified of hecklers, and him and Kremins would just chew him up and spit him out. And he was an inspiration to me because I went to the same high school as Lenny. And if it wasn't for Lenny, I might not have ever done stand-up, honestly, because I grew up two blocks from the Ding Ho, and he was hosting a Wednesday night open mic night, and I had heard about it, and I said, Lenny, and this was like unheard of back then, No one was doing comedy. I said, Lenny, could I come down? He goes, yeah, anybody can come down. Come on, come the fuck down. Come on. And I did, and he put me on, and I started closing his show because I had a very high power rack when I first started. I played harmonica. I did the Test Tube Baby Blues. Thank God I'm a city boy. Thank God I'm a Burbite. The Pooper Scooper Blues. I come on stage with a trench coat, a hat, sunglasses. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, lovers, faggots, fuckers, Republicans, Democrats, intellectuals, marine biologists, cocksuckers, and thieves. My name is Jim. And I would I would do this rap poetry and stuff. I'm a test tube baby. That's why I got the blues. Was a man-made mutation, scientifically abused. I was the miracle of the laboratory. How come I never made 60 Minutes or even the news?
Oh, shut up.
Yeah, yeah. And we had fun,
Yeah, so no one's following that.
No. Our closest show. Yeah. It was like 1 in the morning. It was one of those shows that they had all kinds of people. They had one guy, this guy, Mr. My Way, would come in, and he would drive an ice cream truck, and people would bite his, he wanted people to bite his elbow. And it was crazy. It was open mic night. It was crazy. Oh. But anyway, so Lenny was a, was a friend and is a friend and an inspiration. Like I said, I might not have ever done it if it wasn't for him and Barry Crumman starting that place.
Well, last name, and I only say this because he's the guy who put us together, Barry Katz.
Barry Katz, man. You know, when I was in the throes of, you know, in a very low spot in my career or in my life because of drinking, and I was doing crack Barry's room, played against Sam's, and I was acting up, and I was on stage, and I was fucking hammered, and I was throwing plates around like they were frisbees, you know, these like crowded room, you know?
Yeah.
And Barry's talking to me after. He goes, "Jimmy, man, you're fucking killing yourself. You know, you could be a really good comic." And, you know, and my girlfriend at the time was going, "Listen to Barry. Listen to what he's saying. He's trying to help you, you fucking idiot." You know,
yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to get through this alcoholic haze, you know. But it really resonated because he cared enough. And, you know, I always loved Barry. I got along with him all the time. We started together when he was doing Popeye the Sailor Man, having orgasms when he was doing impressions. When he started as a comic, he's doing Popeye having an orgasm. That was his, you know, his first 5 minutes.
This is the guy that I let vet my set before I did television.
But I have to tell you, man, he has a big heart, and I'm working with him again. I'm psyched to be working with him, but he really did. He reached out and he tried to help somebody, you know, and I was that guy. And, you know, I eventually ended up doing that detox route and trying to get clean. And it's been the best thing, man. It's been the best thing. I recommend it to anybody out there who wants to get better. If you're having a bad, if you feel like your life sucks and a booze has something to do with it, there is a way to get better, yeah. You know, and there is help, and there's lots of places to get help these days from alcohol or drugs. And that's one of the things I want to try to continue working with Humor for Humanity, trying to, you know, carry that message. And that's why I was in the Billerica House of Correction like 2 months ago doing, I think I told you that, right?
Yeah.
I was doing it. I'm telling these inmates, I said, you guys can get sober. And if you do, not only are you helping you, but you're helping your kids. You're helping your family. There's like a residual effect when you know, because now you're responsible and now you can work. And you're asking these inmates, what's the number one thing you want? And guys are saying, a ride home. You know, they're like literally got no job. They got nothing. Most of them in there, 80% of the inmates are there for alcohol and drug-related crimes, you know. So it's a huge problem, but there's also a tremendous amount of hope and a lot of help out there for people who want it.
Well, Jimmy, I want to thank you. This has been a blast, man.
Thank you, brother. And I want to tell you one thing. Can I give you one more name?
Please.
About 10 years ago, I did a fundraiser with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, right?
Holy shit.
The Nobel Prize winner from South Africa. He was the spiritual force. He organized the churches. The whole time Mandela was in prison, he was the spiritual force organizing the churches in South Africa in the 80s and 90s. So I do this fundraiser. And the reason I say this, because you were talking about the airport security bit. And one of the bits in the airport security is, you know, they're asking you the questions. You know, did anybody give you anything to bring onto the plane? Did you pack your bags yourself? And of course, in the show, I'm saying, no, I didn't pack them. A stranger from the Middle East packed them. Right?
Yeah.
I could not believe he knew exactly what to bring. Toothbrush from Mr. Jimmy. Yeah. And, so anyway, so I'm hosting this. I'm the MC, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu is the keynote speaker, and this is AIDS benefit in Boston. So I got to sit at the head table with him, talk to him, asking him about Mandela, asking him about apartheid. He was a big fan of Hillary Clinton. He was saying he was a big fan of Bill. Anyway, so after the show, I get off stage, and I'm going up to my room, and I got my bags, and I'm with my wife at the time, and my wife still, Catherine, love you, honey. Anyway, I get on the elevator with my bags. Who comes in the elevator but Archbishop Desmond Tutu? And he looks at me, and he goes, hey, he goes, did you pack your bag yourself? Did you pack them yourself? Funny bastard he is.
Oh, shit. Well, I got a lot of work to do. I got a lot of work to do, imagine.
Fun being on with you,
so I got a Desmond Tutu story.
Yeah, you got a Desmond Tutu story.
Jimmy,
he's the best.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This episode was brought to you by The Machine.